Chapter 52. Liverpool on it. I don't know why, unless because the Ferndale was registered in Liverpool. It was very thick plate glass. Anyhow, the upper part got smashed, and directly we had attended to things aloft, Mr. Franklin had set the carpenter to patch up the damage with some pieces of plain glass. I don't know where they got them. I think the people who fitted up new bookcases in the captain's room had left some spare panes. Chips was there the whole afternoon on his knees, messing with putty and red lead. It wasn't a neat job when it was done, not by any means, but it would serve to keep the weather out and let the light in. Clear glass. And of course I was not thinking of it. I just stooped to pick up that rope, and found my head within 3 inches of that clear glass, and dash it all. I found myself out. Not half an hour before I was saying to myself that it was impossible to tell what was in people's heads, or at the back of their talk, or what they were likely to be up to. And here I found myself up to as low a trick as you can well think of. For, after I had stooped, there I remained prying, spying, anyway looking, where I had no business to look. Not consciously at first, maybe. He who has eyes, you know, nothing can stop him from seeing things, as long as there are things to see in front of him. What I saw at first was the end of the table, and the tray clamped onto it, a patent tray for sea use, fitted with holders for a couple of decanters, water jug and glasses. The glitter of these things caught my eye first, but what I saw next was the captain down there, alone as far as I could see, and I could see pretty well the whole of that part up to the cottage piano, dark against the satin wood paneling of the bulkhead. And I remained looking. I did. And I don't know that I was ashamed of myself either then. It was the fault of that Franklin, always talking of the man, making free with him to that extent, that really he seemed to have become our property, his and mine, in a way. It's funny, but one had that feeling about Captain Anthony. To watch him was not so much worse than listening to Franklin talking him over. Well, it's no use making excuses for what's inexcusable. I watched, but I dare say you know that there could have been nothing inimical in this low behavior of mine. On the contrary, I'll tell you now what he was doing. He was helping himself out of a decanter. I saw every movement, and I said to myself mockingly, as though jeering at Franklin in my thoughts, "Hallo! Here's the captain taking to drink at last." Apostrophe, apostrophe, he poured a little brandy, or whatever it was, into a long glass, filled it with water, drank about a fourth of it, and stood the glass back into the holder. Every sign of a bad drinking bout, I was saying to myself, feeling quite amused at the notions of that Franklin. He seemed to me an enormous ass, with his jealousy and his fears. At that rate a month would not have been enough for anybody to get drunk. The captain sat down in one of the swivel armchairs fixed around the table. I had him right under me, and as he turned the chair slightly, I was looking, I may say, down his back. He took another little sip, and then reached for a book which was lying on the table. I had not noticed it before. Altogether the proceedings of a desperate drunkard, weren't they? He opened the book, and held it before his face. If this was the way he took to drink, then I needn't worry. He was in no danger from that, and as to any other, I assure you no human being could have looked safer than he did down there. I felt the greatest contempt for Franklin just then, while I looked at Captain Anthony sitting there with a glass of weak brandy and water at his elbow, and reading in the cabin of his ship, on a quiet night the quietest, perhaps the finest, of a prosperous passage. And if you wonder why I didn't leave off my ugly spying, I will tell you how it was. Captain Anthony was a great reader just about that time, and I have a great liking for books. To this day I can't come near a book, but I must know what it is about. It was a thickish volume he had there, small close print, double columns, I can see it now. What I wanted to make out was the title at the top of the page. I have very good eyes, but he wasn't holding it conveniently, I mean for me up there. Well, it was a history of some kind, That much I read, and then suddenly he bangs the book face down on the table, jumps up as if something had bitten him, and walks away aft. Funny thing shame is. I had been behaving badly, and aware of it in a way, but I didn't feel really ashamed till the fright of being found out in my honorable occupation drove me from it. I slunk away to the forward end of the poop and lounged about there, my face and ears burning and glad it was a dark night, expecting every moment to hear the captain's footsteps behind me. For I made sure he was coming on deck. Presently I thought I had rather meet him face to face, and I walked slowly aft prepared to see him emerge from the companion, before I got that far. I even thought of his having detected me by some means. But it was impossible, unless he had eyes in the top of his head. I had never had a view of his face down there. It was impossible, I was safe, and I felt very mean, yet, explain it as you may, I seemed not to care. And the captain not appearing on deck, I had the impulse to go on being mean. I wanted another peep. I really don't know what was the beastly influence except that Mr. Franklin's talk was enough to demoralize any man, by raising a sort of unhealthy curiosity which did away in my case with all the restraints of common decency. I did not mean to run the risk of being caught squatting in a suspicious attitude by the captain. There was also the helmsman to consider. So what I did, I am surprised at my low cunning, was to sit down naturally on the skylight seat, and then by bending forward I found that, as I expected, I could look down through the upper part of the end pane. The worst that could happen to me then, if I remained too long in that position, was to be suspected by the seaman aft at the wheel of having gone to sleep there. For the rest, my ears would give me sufficient warning of any movements in the companion. But in that way my angle of view was changed. The field too was smaller. The end of the table, the tray and the swivel chair I had right under my eyes. The captain had not come back yet. The piano I could not see now, but on the other hand I had a very oblique downward view of the curtains drawn across the cabin, and cutting off the forward part of it just about the level of the skylight end, and only an inch or so from the end of the table. They were heavy stuff, traveling on a thick brass rod with some contrivance to keep the rings from sliding to and fro when the ship rolled. But just then the ship was as still almost as a model shut up in a glass case, while the curtains, joined closely, and, perhaps on purpose, made a little too long, moved no more than a solid wall. Marlowe got up to get another cigar. The night was getting on to what I may call its deepest hour, the hour most favorable to evil purposes of men's hate, despair, or greed, to whatever can whisper into their ears the unlawful counsels of protest against things that are, the hour of ill-omened silence and chill and stagnation, the hour when the criminal plies his trade, and the victim of sleeplessness reaches the lowest depth of dreadful discouragement, the hour before the first sight of dawn. I know it, because while Marlowe was crossing the room I looked at the clock on the mantelpiece. He, however, never looked that way, though it is possible that he too was aware of the passage of time. He sat down heavily. Our friend Powell, he began again, was very anxious that I should understand the topography of that cabin. I was interested more by its moral atmosphere, that tension of falsehood, of desperate acting, which tainted the pure sea atmosphere into which the magnanimous Anthony had carried off his conquest, and well his self-conquest too, trying to act at the same time like a beast of prey, a pure spirit and the us generous of men. Too big an order clearly, because he was nothing of a monster, but just a common mortal, a little more self-willed and self-confident than most, maybe, both in his roughness and in his delicacy. As to the delicacy of Mr. Powell's proceedings, I'll say nothing. He found a sort of depraved excitement in watching an unconscious man and such an attractive and mysterious man as Captain Anthony at that. He wanted another peep at him. He surmised that the captain must come back soon, because of the glass two-thirds full, and also of the book put down so brusquely. God knows what sudden pang had made Anthony jump up so. I am convinced he used reading as an opiate against the pain of his magnanimity, which, like all abnormal growths, was gnawing at his healthy substance with cruel persistence. Perhaps he had rushed into his cabin simply to groan freely in absolute and delicate secrecy. At any rate, he tarried there. And young Powell would have grown weary and compunctious at last if it had not become manifest to him that he had not been alone in the highly incorrect occupation of watching the movements of Captain Anthony. Powell explained to me that no sound did, or perhaps could, reach him from the saloon. The first sign, and we must remember that he was using his eyes for all they were worth, was an unaccountable movement of the curtain. It was wavy and very slight, just perceptible in fact to the sharpened faculties of a secret watcher, for it can't be denied that our wits are much more alert when engaged in wrongdoing in which one mustn't be found out than in a righteous occupation. He became suspicious, with no one and nothing definite in his mind. He was suspicious of the curtain itself and observed it. It looked very innocent. Then, just as he was ready to put it down to a trick of imagination, he saw trembling movements where the two curtains joined. Yes. Somebody else besides himself had been watching Captain Anthony. He owns artlessly that this roused his indignation. It was really too much of a good thing. In this state of intense antagonism, he was startled to observe tips of fingers fumbling with the dark stuff. Then they grasped the edge of the further curtain and hung on there, just fingers and knuckles and nothing else. It made an abominable sight. He was looking at it with unaccountable repulsion when a hand came into view, a short, puffy, old, freckled hand projecting into the lamplight, followed by a white wrist, an arm in a gray coat sleeve, up to the elbow, beyond the elbow, extended tremblingly towards the tray. Its appearance was weird and nauseous, fantastic and silly. But instead of grabbing the bottle as Powell expected, this hand, tremulous with senile eagerness, swerved to the glass, rested on its edge for a moment or so it looked from above, and went back with a jerk. The gripping fingers of the other hand vanished at the same time, and young Powell, staring at the motionless curtains, could indulge for a moment the notion that he had been dreaming. But that notion did not last long. Powell, after repressing his first impulse to spring for the companion and hammer at the captain's door, took steps to have himself relieved by the boatswain. He was in a state of distraction as to his feelings, and yet lucid as to his mind. He remained on the skylight so as to keep his eye on the tray. Still the captain did not appear in the saloon. If he had, said Mr. Powell, I knew what to do. I would have put my elbow through the pane instantly crash. I asked him why. It was the quickest dodge for getting him away from that tray, he explained. My throat was so dry that I didn't know if I could shout loud enough. And this was not a case for shouting either. The boatswain, sleepy and disgusted, arriving on the poop, found the second officer doubled up over the end of the skylight in a pose which might have been that of severe pain. And his voice was so changed that the man, though naturally vexed at being turned out, made no comment on the plea of sudden indisposition which young Powell put forward. The rapidity with which the sick man got off the poop must have astonished the boatswain. But Powell, at the moment he opened the door leading into the saloon from the quarter deck, had managed to control his agitation. He entered swiftly, but without noise, and found himself in the dark part of the saloon, the strong sheen of the lamp on the other side of the curtains visible only above the rod on which they ran. The door of Mr. Smith's cabin was in that dark part. He passed by it, assuring himself by a quick side glance that it was imperfectly closed. S, he said to me. The old man must have been watching through the crack. Of that I am certain. But it was not for me that he was watching and listening. Horrible. Surely he must have been startled to hear and see somebody he did not expect. He could not possibly guess why I was coming in, but I suppose he must have been concerned. Concerned indeed. He must have been thunderstruck, appalled. Powell's only distinct aim was to remove the suspected tumbler. He had no other plan, no other intention, no other thought. Do away with it in some manner. Snatch it up and run out with it. You know that complete mastery of one fixed idea, not a reasonable, but an emotional mastery, a sort of concentrated exaltation. Under its empire men rush blindly through fire and water and opposing violence, and nothing can stop them unless, sometimes, a grain of sand. For his blind purpose, and clearly the thought of Mrs. Anthony was at the bottom of it, Mr. Powell had plenty of time. What checked him at the crucial moment was the familiar, harmless aspect of common things, the steady light, the open book on the table, the solitude, the peace, the home-like effect of the place. He held the glass in his hand. All he had to do was to vanish back beyond the curtains, flee with it noiselessly into the night on deck, fling it unseen overboard. A minute or less. And then all that would have happened would have been the wonder at the utter disappearance of a glass tumbler, a ridiculous riddle in pantry affairs beyond the wit of anyone on board to solve. The grain of sand against which Powell stumbled in his headlong career was a moment of incredulity, as to the truth of his own conviction, because it had failed to affect the safe aspect of familiar things. He doubted his eyes too. He must have dreamt it all. I'm dreaming now, he said to himself. And very likely for a few seconds he must have looked like a man in a trance, or profoundly asleep on his feet, and with a glass of brandy and water in his hand. What woke him up, and, at the same time, fixed his feet immovably to the spot, was a voice asking him what he was doing there in tones of thunder. Or so it sounded to his ears. Anthony, opening the door of his stern cabin, had naturally exclaimed. What else could you expect? And the exclamation must have been fairly loud, if you consider the nature of the sight which met his eye. There, before him, stood his second officer, a seemingly decent, well-bred young man, who, being on duty, had left the deck, and had sneaked into the saloon, apparently for the inexpressibly mean purpose of drinking up what was left of his captain's brandy and water. There he was, caught absolutely with the glass in his hand. But the very monstrosity of appearances silenced Anthony after the first exclamation, and young Powell felt himself pierced through and through by the overshadowed glance of his captain. Anthony advanced quietly. The first impulse of Mr. Powell, when discovered, had been to dash the glass on the deck. He was in a sort of panic. But deep down within him his wits were working, and the idea, that if he did, that he could prove nothing, and that the story he had to tell was completely incredible, restrained him. The captain came forward slowly. With his eyes now close to his, Powell, spellbound, numb all over, managed to lift one finger to the deck above, mumbling the explanatory words, "Boatswain on the poop." The captain moved his head slightly, as much as to say, "That's all right," and this was all. Powell had no voice, no strength. The air was unbreathable, thick, sticky, odious, like hot jelly in which all movements became difficult. He raised the glass a little with immense difficulty, and moved his trammeled lips sufficiently to form the words, "Doctored." Anthony glanced at it for an instant, only for an instant, and again fastened his eyes on the face of his second mate. Powell added a fervent belief, and put the glass down on the tray. The captain's glance followed the movement, and returned sternly to his face. The young man pointed a finger once more upwards, and squeezed out of his iron-bound throat six consecutive words of further explanation. "Row the skylight. The white pane." The captain raised his eyebrows very much at this, while young Powell, ashamed but desperate, nodded insistently several times. He meant to say that. Yes. Yes. He had done that thing. He had been spying. The captain's gaze became thoughtful. And, now the confession was over, the iron-bound feeling of Powell's throat passed away, giving place to a general anxiety which from his breast seemed to extend to all the limbs and organs of his body. His legs? Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.